This is Dr. Patty Shelton, and you are listening to the LongevIQ podcast. We discuss anti-aging and longevity science and how to benefit from it so we can all live long, healthy, happy lives. Just before we get started, a quick medical disclaimer. This podcast is for informational purposes only. It is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or to provide or replace medical advice. Please use this information to educate yourself as much as possible and share this information with a qualified health practitioner that you trust. Longevity and anti-aging medicine is an emerging field with many promising and exciting options to choose from. But do any of these actually work? What is the evidence? Are there any risks? Our guest in this episode is Dr. Neil Palvin, a functional anti-aging medicine physician who specializes in combining cutting-edge science, technology, and personalized precision medicine to help his patients optimize their health, performance, and longevity. As we'll discuss, there are quite a few things we can do that can be very beneficial. At the same time, there is no one-size-fits-all plan that works best for everyone, although there are some key principles that can help guide us along the way. Also joining us today, as always, is Amir Ginsberg, the founder of LongevIQ. Welcome, Dr. Palvin. Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
All right. Well, you have a really impressive background with a lot of kind of diverse education in anti-aging. So we'd love to start with just your overall view of anti-aging. How do you view longevity and longevity medicine?
That's a long question right there. I mean, longevity medicine is very evolving right now. It's something that there's a lot of noise, a lot of influencers out there saying things that aren't true. There's a lot of over-promising, under-delivering, but there's also a lot of great potential. So it's something where, I mean, I would say, just to kind of summarize, there's things that are coming down the road. There's things that I tell my patients right now, there's nothing that's been proven to help elongate lifespan in humans yet. There's a lot of things that hopefully in the next 2 or 3 years that may greatly change. We'll know what works and what doesn't. But you also have to, in this whole environment, have to be very buyer beware, because there's a lot of people saying and selling a lot of stuff that has no benefit whatsoever, may actually hurt yourself. So it's a fun that there's a lot of promise, a lot of investment going into it, but also very, very confusing right now.
That's a really important message for people to hear. So thank you for sharing that. And I notice on your website, you talk a lot about optimizing. So optimizing human potential. So I'd love to talk about, what are we actually optimizing for? You know, are we optimizing for performance now? Are we optimizing for longevity? Is there a trade-off between those things? How can people look at what to optimize?
I mean, optimize is a buzzword. So it doesn't have, I mean, you talk to 10 different people or 10 different doctors, you're going to get 10 different answers and they all may be right. So the point being is, optimize means A, what you're looking for. I mean, there are people who may just want to just feel better. I mean, and that's all they want. They're not somebody who's going to take 22 different supplements or 10 IVs or lock themselves in a hyperbaric for an hour. But if they get the right sleep and the right exercise program, and they have the right diet, they're optimizing their health, and there's data that they can potentially increase their lifespan. There's also people who are doing IVs and are fasting and have 20, and they also are working on optimize their lifespan. Or their health, at least what we call their health span now. So optimization is just trying to make yourself better in either your cognitive performance, your sports performance, your weight, your whatever you're potentially working on. But also, again, it breaks down to the simple foundational things that we know, the things that actually do already connect to health, lifespan, and optimizing health are how many relationships you have, how happy you are. So, and those are free. So there's a full gamut of how you optimize your health. As long as you're doing something, that's great. And I tell my patients, I'm like your tour guide in optimization. We can do simple things. We could go down the rabbit hole together, as long as you understand what works, what doesn't. And and kind of the question in terms of interacting, what can they counteract each other? If you're doing too many things without knowing what you're doing, you could counteract and get end up going negative. The other thing would be, like I think I mentioned to you right in the beginning, is you got to start the foundational things. It's got to be exercise. It's got to be sleep. It's got to be stress management. It's got to be diet. So if those aren't there, the rest of the stuff is kind of superfluous or going to be not really work much, and you're spending a lot of money. It looks cool on social media, but you may not get too far. So that's kind of the broad strokes question. I mean, again, this is ever evolving. But it's a very cool adventure.
Do you sometimes see, for example, a trade-off between like someone optimizing for sports performance right now versus optimizing for longevity? Like, are there times when you might need to do something different to optimize for those two different outcomes? Or do you see that they normally kind of go together?
I mean, it's both. If you're optimizing for a sports competition, I'm in Manhattan, and a lot of my patients are going to run the New York Marathon in a couple of weeks. So they're putting extra time. It's kind of the way I have a lot of cheesy analogies. Right now, what they're just trying to do is they're trying to fill the bucket faster than it's leaking. I mean, they're putting a lot of, knowing running a marathon is not a normal stress to put on anybody. It's great for your body to be able to show that it can do it. So yeah, at that point, we're doing certain injections, or they're doing hyperbaric, or they're taking antioxidants, which for short-term activity are great. We know long-term antioxidants are not healthy. They decrease performance, can decrease brain function. So yeah, in that regard, there is a trade-off. There's certain probably three or four different things that you can be in which are great in the short term and not great in the long term. Definitely sports, the people who are trying to maximize their growth hormone, their testosterone to maximize their performance. That's great for the next 6 months, but we know there may be some downside in the long term. You have high testosterone, lead to estrogen and high estrogen and inflammation and so on. There's people who do a lot of cosmetic stuff to look their best. Those things have some toxic effects. They decrease some ability to produce testosterone or female hormones appropriately. So you may be robbing Peter to pay Paul a little bit. So yeah, those are the types of things that may counteract each other a little bit. And again, you're an adult. You at least in my case, most of my patients and most adults know what they prioritize. They understand plus and minuses, and they're going to make that decision. The problem is a lot of people, they just see somebody on social media or on TV. Oh, wow, they look really great. What are they doing? And that's all they see. They see the golden carrot, and they don't understand the repercussions of things.
Really important message. Yeah. And if somebody is optimizing for longevity, obviously we don't know ahead of time how long they're going to live. So we need some way of measuring. So what are your favorite ways of measuring somebody's aging, testing for kind of healthy aging? What do you use normally?
There's a lot of things. And there's no one great one. I mean, the one that's actually, again, a lot of for all the cool tests out there, I mean, it's the one that, again, the ones I mentioned before, I mean, again, relationships and positivity, and those things are actually good measures. Grip strength is actually one of the simple measures that we know has some data behind it. As well. So, I mean, that's kind of the starting point from the basic things. We can check inflammatory markers, something like a CRP, which is helpful to let us know where patients are. You can look at oxidative stress through several markers, which is the body's damage from inflammation and certain pathways not working the way they should, and toxins and things like that. There are now things that are out there called biological age clocks. They are definitely a work in progress. They are not, I mean, even the leading experts out there will say they're not ready for prime time yet. They're a nice gauge as a number. I mean, so for those who don't know biological age clock, they look at methylation pathways or combination of other pathways in the body to see you may be 52 based on your birth date, but your cells may say that you're 42, which means you're doing the right thing in theory. It also may say that you may be 52, but it says that you're 62, which means that you're kind of going down the wrong way. Is that gospel? No, but it's something, again, if you take that and their cholesterol is good, their inflammation markers are good, their grip strength is good, you can kind of put the whole big picture together. those are things that we definitely look at. We definitely look at, I mean, sugar levels, hemoglobin A1C. We know that that leads to many different issues as well. So that's the kind of the starter pack. And then depending on what people are specifically looking at, we can kind of go from there.
And so you're saying it's good to have several different ways of testing rather than choosing one test and just taking it as your gospel for how well you're aging. You want to look at a bigger picture, more different things.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh.
Let's talk a little bit about, because you mentioned sort of these pillars, right? Nutrition, exercise, sleep. With nutrition, what do you find typically works well for people as far as eating patterns? Do you find particular diets tend to be good? How do you figure out for an individual kind of what the ideal anti-aging eating pattern might be?
If I knew this, I would be a billionaire at this point. This is probably one of the biggest things that I mentioned in the beginning, where if you ask me this question 3 years from now, I probably would have a much better answer than there is now. There's been a lot of data refuting things and a lot of data promoting things, and we just don't know for sure, because nutritional studies notorious for having horrible data, because people either can't track their own data, or they lie about what they ate, or a hamburger from one place is not the same. It's just very hard to kind of get a clear guidance on. So there's a couple of things that we do know. Time-restricted eating, meaning that patients who eat in a certain window, it's not the same thing as fasting, meaning that you're eating all your food in about an 8-hour window, usually in the morning. So it's not just having a window, it's having a window in the morning is actually better for you potentially than eating even an 8-hour window in the evening, because of what's called your circadian rhythm, and you have clocks, which so your body just will work better. Insulin is more sensitive. Your hormones are better if you eat in an 8-hour window from 9 to 4, 9 to 5, as opposed to eating later in the day. I mean, so that we know, that's something that's starting to show up. Beyond that, the answer is whatever diet works for you, unless there's a specific medical issue. We know obviously the common sense thing, you should not be eating sugar every day. That's, we know, and then beyond that, it's just a really huge debate. And whoever is, people who are all about paleo, there's people who are all about fat, like fasting. There's all people who say that anti-inflammatory diets are better. And there's just, the data isn't there yet. We know, again, we know that the healthier you eat, the less processed food you eat is better for you. And you don't go down the rabbit holes with those. Obviously, if you eat inflammatory foods, things like sugar, in some patients, gluten. I know I'm sensitive to dairy, so that sets off an inflammatory action in me. So it's kind of more individual. What works for me is not going to work for somebody else. It's listening to your body. And we can also now tell that on certain lab tests, if you have inflammation or your body comes back, or you have a celiac where you're kind of allergic to gluten, then we can work with it. The key is, time may be bigger in points as more and more data comes out. We know that you want to not be eating as many meals, like people eat 4, 5, 6 meals a day. That probably is not as good as eating a couple of meals a day, just because of the way the hormones go up and down. Obviously avoiding sugar and things like that, and not eating processed foods all the time. That's kind of what we know. And there's some people who are keto. If you have a neurological issue, we know a keto diet can be very helpful. We also now are seeing some benefits potentially psychiatric wise, things like bipolar disease. So if you have IBS or especially a gastrointestinal issue called SIBO or inflammatory bowel disease, a FODMAPs diet, at least a modified one where you're avoiding certain foods, could be helpful. Everybody wants a cookie cutter plan. It doesn't work. Besides some basic things. I wish, talk to me in 3 years and we probably have a lot more information. Another thing I would mention really quickly is some data on a 5-day water fast, either full 5-day water fast or doing what they call a mimicking diet through, there's different brands out there. I'm not sure if you want me to mention brands or not, that have been shown to have really good efficacy in terms of long-term health data. So it's either the time restricted in the short term, or doing like a long-term, either fat water fast or fasting mimicking fast, where you're getting certain calories, but it's in a certain amount of certain macronutrients. That's something you'd want to talk to your healthcare provider about.
How often would someone normally want to do a 5-day fast like this?
In a perfect world, at least once every 3 months. I mean, there's people who do it monthly. In theory, it's every 3 months.
I think one of the popular ones, the fasting mimicking diet, is called Prolon. It's one of the most studied one, right?
Yeah, they have the most data out there right now. There's other companies and other programs working on their data, but they have the most data by far right now.
And since we're talking about food sensitivities and how they're different in each person, how would you recommend somebody go about trying to figure out which foods they might be sensitive to? Like, what's the process for that?
Okay, I'm going to probably aggravate a lot of people when I say this, but we just kind of know more and more now. So I'm sensitive, either you're allergic to a food where you're getting a reaction, a rash, or it comes up positive on your allergy blood test that's run through your regular doctor or allergist. Or sensitivity then becomes in air quotes where you, if you eat certain foods, that you feel flushed or you feel bloated or you have brain fog. In terms of any lab tests for food sensitivity, they've kind of been disproven to a certain extent. I know they're very popular out there. I mean, I have patients who come in and say, oh, I did this test or that test, and it says I'm sensitive to every food under the sun. The data just isn't there anymore to prove that they actually work. I know they actually did a couple times where if you do the same test multiple times for a food sensitivity test and you did it, same person, same basic diet, one time we'll say you're sensitive to this, one time we'll say you're sensitive to something else. It's not reproducible. I don't love them. I don't really do them much at all, my patients anymore. I'll do that. The only time I will tend to do it is, it's again, like I said, a lot of what I do, there's no perfect test for a lot of these things yet. So you have to take the sum of the whole, of all the parts. So if they're having a bloating issue and nothing else is showing up, we'll kind of trial and error. Okay, this test says you're sensitive to blueberries. This test says you're sensitive to dates. We'll try to get rid of it and see if it works. Sometimes it hits, sometimes it doesn't do anything. So food sensitivities are not gospel. They're a nice part of your packet if you want to use them, but they're not really covered by insurance. So if it's something that you don't want to spend on, don't spend on it.
Do you find it's helpful to have people do an elimination diet of kind of common sensitivities and then add things back?
Yes. And I mean, I guess the simple answer is yes. Just from the data that's out there now, I tell people I kind of play on both sides of the fence. I believe there's a lot of alternative things or integrative or whatever term we're using now are great, but there's got to be some data behind it too to explain it. Yeah. So, I mean, elimination, like I said, I definitely have avoiding sugars. I have avoiding gluten and see how they do and then add it back in. I'll do that with some dairy foods, with cheeses especially, because certain people will be great with cheese and certain people can't do anything at all. Nuts is probably the other food, especially in my autoimmune patients who just don't respond to anything. I have kind of moved a little bit away from the full, because there's so many, it's good to do, but most patients are seeing me or have already done it on their own or with some other practitioner. And there's so many other things out there that are now better to be used for a lot of these conditions than just a full elimination diet where they come back in 2 months and they still, most of them have the same issues. So I use it in conjunction. I use what I call, like I said, a mini elimination diet. I mean, again, if they tell me that if they have gut issues, I'm going to have them eliminate certain FODMAP foods like artichokes and things like that. I'm much more problem specific. Again, I'm going to keep probably saying the same thing about the whole talk here is that everybody's different. Everybody's an N of one. And I'm playing on multiple sides of the fence. So I don't think what's going to work for me is going to work for my wife, is going to work for you. So it's the core two or three things and then going from there.
Kind of a personalized or precision medicine approach.
Yeah, I mean, genetics will help a little bit too. I didn't mention that. I mean, that if you've had a 23andMe or any of the other 100 of genetic tests are out there now. I mean, there's certain genes that show that you can't break down histamine, which we're now finding more and more patients have an issue with what are called mast cells who produce histamine, or they can't break down histamine. That's causing a lot of their bloating or sensitivity. So that will know. If they have celiac genes, which are gluten-related, we can do that. So again, it's putting all the pieces together. A lot of people just come in and say, oh, I just did this elimination diet and it didn't work. I'm like, well, did they fix this or this or this? And they're like, no. I'm like, okay, that's why it didn't work. I have a lot of cheese analogies. I've now really subscribed to what I call the safety deposit box method, meaning you got to turn all the keys at the same time. I got to heal their gut with whatever I'm going to be used, be it supplements, peptides, or something else. We got to adjust your diet a little bit. We got to work on your immune system. If we fix all those things at the same time, then they're going to feel better. If you do one thing and then throw another thing at them and they don't feel better, then there's a reason why. So I tend to be a little more aggressive than most people.
So kind of taking the approach of trying everything all at once rather than just one thing at a time.
Yes. If you know what you're doing, it's, again, that's a simple, I know what I'm doing. There's a lot of people, but yeah, I'm going down a rabbit hole there, but anyway.
We love rabbit holes.
Yeah. But then I get myself in trouble. So, and this is recorded. So I'll stay away from that one.
I see you using quite a few kind of devices for functional medicine or anti-aging. What are some of your favorite pieces of technology that people, you know, that maybe work sometimes for your patients? And obviously really important to be working with a professional if you're trying these things.
Technology is incredible right now. That's why I kind of mentioned that there's some other things that we can use now that we didn't even have 3 or 4 years ago. Technology, a couple of things I really, really like. I love red light therapy because it's something very simple, cost-effective. There's data behind it for a lot of different issues, especially I do a lot of patients who unfortunately have like neurodegenerative issues like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. There's a lot of great studies coming out about that. We use it to alter the microbiome. It can help with inflammation. So that's one. Hyperbaric I love as well. It's a little more price on the pricey side. I mean, it's not something that, but again, there's a lot of incredible data from everything from concussion to inflammation to unfortunately now long COVID patients. So that's something that's amazing. Like a year ago, nobody really was doing it. And now it's like people are asking me, where can I find a hyperbaric or can I have one in my house? So I think that's one. I mean, again, I think that's what's also in terms of all this stuff, what I love and I don't love, but mostly love at the same time is the paradigm in this type of thing has kind of changed in the sense that it used to be the doctor educating the patient and saying things. Now there's definitely either a symbiosis where a lot of my patients are very educated. They see things. They just say, okay, I want to do A, B, and C. How do I implement this in the right way? I'll have a hyperbaric in my home or a sauna in my home or whatever. And then they're doing things on their own to maintain their health, prevent them from getting sick instead of the old paradigm we have where I'm sick. I feel like garbage. Now let me go see the doctor. I think that's what makes technology really a good thing. The other one that I really like, besides the red light and the hyperbaric, I mean, there's a couple other ones that I do like. But yeah, in terms of other technologies that are out there, I mean, there's PMF, which is great for inflammation. That's very helpful. Those are probably the main things I love that have really great. But another one I really like is transcranial stimulation. That's really shown a lot of benefit in terms of, again, in psychiatric illnesses, anxiety, depression, PTSD. I think those are the things that are really ready for prime time. I think there's a couple other things that are going to, in the next year or two, once the data comes out, are going to be incredibly helpful. And actually, there are products now that are really great in a very simple way, can help with HRV, heart rate variability, as well as calm anxiety and pain. Products that you can wear around your wrist that vibrate. And they have data where it elevates HRV, help with mood. And it's something very simple, not that expensive, and it's very fruitful. So I think those are the ones. And the last thing I'll say, and I kind of hinted at it, is all the wearables are out there. I mean, there's two or three that I really strongly recommend to patients. But patients knowing at least their HRV, what their resting heart rate is, what their pulse ox is, now that with the new Apple Watches, knowing the heart rhythm, are they having some type of irregular heartbeat where it tells them, oh, you need to go to the hospital. Now they can do their blood pressure at home and it will be on their watch or whatever it happens to be. Patients knowing their data, most patients want to be healthy. So if they know, oh my God, my pressure is high or my heart rate is too high or my pulse ox thing. I mean, there's numerous patients, unfortunately, who had a low pulse ox, whatever, however they were measuring and realized, unfortunately, there was something wrong over the last couple of years. So I think that's something that's also going to be much cooler and cooler in the next couple of years, where all these technologies where they'll know everything from their blood sugar to their insulin level, and you have it right at home.
How do you feel about continuous glucose monitors? Do you feel like they're helpful, or do you feel like maybe it's too much data or overkill?
Again, I'm going to be the Debbie Downer with that one. I think it's obviously great for diabetics because that they have all the data is going to be the non-stick ones coming out hopefully in the next year to 18 months. So it'll be great for them. as opposed to having to do finger sticks all the time. So that regard, they're good. In terms of from an anti-aging front, I mean, I'm going to go with what most people are saying. It's not a great utility to it. It's good to do once a year, where you want to see how your sugars, when you eat a certain food, does your sugar spike with something? I mean, there's people who have told me, yes, about food sensitivities before. There's patients who have told me, and the respected doctors or scientists I respect, they'll say, I just had a strawberry, my blood sugar spiked through the roof. I took it away for 6 months, and wow, I just felt so much better. So that may be, in terms of giving food sensitivities, that's almost what I tell my patients now. I find that actually gives me, there's a much more A to B result there. And it's good to see how your body responds to exercise. If your body has a really big spike with your sugars, then you know you're either pushing your body too hard. If you crash, obviously you may not be working out too hard, or may not be feeding yourself enough to get through your workout. Again, you can combine that data with your HRV data and potentially what your blood pressure and heart rate are, and it helps in that regard. But and honestly, after a month or two, things don't really change that much. I mean, you could, again, it's something if you want to monitor your workout every 3 months and see how your body responds, great. But for what they cost right now, again, after the first month, I don't think there's a huge utility with it right now. I think, again, that's something that they're working on new things. Again, if you ask me another 18 months, that may change. But right now, there's other things I'd like to use. I mean,
just really important, like, overall message there, actually, which is just because we can measure something doesn't mean that it's meaningful to do so, or that it's actually going to help us in any kind of way.
Yeah. And what we see now with wearables, and I mean, I literally get this question daily, is, okay, my HRV is this, or there's a couple that have their own scores. What does this mean? So they have a number, they have no idea what it means, what to do about it. And I'm like, then what do you like? Oh, well, my trainer looks at it. So I think we're getting now at that point where we have so much data, but a lot of people don't know what to do about it or do with it. I mean, I will work my patients on it, but traditional doctors don't look at it. Trainers have some training with it, but they don't know how to do it from a medical perspective. So that's going to be an area that's going to need to get filled in somehow. As more and more, I think, of these wearable devices become mainstream, with like lactate levels and insulin levels and all this stuff, it's going to be science overwhelm. I know this is the first time in like a year where a lot of sales have decreased of wearables, just because they realizing, I just don't know what to do with this, and I'm just going to do other things.
Yeah. What's the point of collecting a whole bunch of data if you don't know what you're going to change based on that data?
Exactly.
Yeah. How do you feel about cold therapy? I've seen you on your website talking a little bit about this, or on your social media.
Cold therapy, like a lot of things out there now, if you use it for good, it's great. It could also be a little evil, in the sense that it's not like the end all be all. It's very good for inflammation. It's great for the psychiatric benefits in terms of neurotransmitter release. It helps your immune system, especially if you're doing it in a cold plunge, not just in a shower. Meaning, like, some people just cold showers. It also helps regulate your nervous system between your sympathetic, which is your fight or flight, and your parasympathetic, which is your calming nervous part of your nervous system. That is all beneficial from cold, especially cold immersion, which is a cold plunge. Cold shower has some benefits, but not as much. We know that from studies now. In terms of what's called cryotherapy, where they put you in the minus 200 degree booth, some people like it for inflammation. The data is just not as good from cryotherapy as opposed to cold immersion. I know most of have switched from more cold cryo to cold immersion. But there are people who like it. I mean, and they've works. Again, you're not going to get the psychiatric benefits as much, but you will get the anti-inflammatory benefits. You just need to be a little more careful. I've had more patients have either some neurological damage or other issues, burns and frostbite from it. So there's a little more risk to it as well. And also, the great thing about doing a cold immersion or even a cold shower is you can complement that with breath work a little bit easier. There's data now showing the breath work with the cold immersion actually has better benefit than just doing either one individually. So I'm a much more of a cold immersion guy. The one caveat with all that is the weight loss kind of thing that a lot of people are saying about it. The data is all over the place with that. It may help you lose weight. It will definitely activate brown fat. Is there going to be a dramatic weight loss effect to it long-term? Probably not, but that's still being studied pretty right now.
And you sort of alluded a little bit to this, but there's a too much clearly with the cold immersion. So how much of that should people be doing? Like, how long is safe? How often is safe? Is this a thing that varies person to person?
Well, it definitely varies person to person. I mean, I'm in the middle to high. I have friends who can barely do 1 minute and they're happy with that. This is something, again, I'll say it's, we'll know more in a, probably another year or two. We do know there's data that says about 11 to 15 minutes is probably optimal for the week. We definitely don't want to also limit a little bit after you do an anabolic or a strength workout, because it will decrease your hypertrophy, the anabolic effect of the workout. So you need to be a little bit aware of that as well. I mean, a lot of these places, if you go to, there are places, at least by me, that are now cold therapy studios, quote unquote, and they, it looks cool to, for your social media, let's do 6 minutes or 7 minutes. The data that it actually may have bad effects for some people is out there. Again, everything's individual. Kind of funny, I have some older athletes I see, and they're like, we've been doing this for 30 years. There's nothing, this is not new. It's just become more popular. And now they have cool, instead of being in a metal tub, it's now there's, now that you can buy a $10,000, $15,000 cold plunge, and again, whatever works for you is great, but they sit in there for 15, 20 minutes and they feel better. But the data is really 11 to 15 minutes, maybe the sweet spot, except maybe if you're trying to do it for inflammation where there's a little more play there.
And it's 11 to 15 minutes all at once a week, or is that 11 to 15 minutes spread apart in different
throughout sessions? The week. I mean, most people, they say, this is, there's some people that say, most people say 3 to 4. Some people say up to 6 minutes. I've seen data that 6 minutes may be too much. I like 3 or 4 is a nice happy medium for most people.
And so then we'd be doing that maybe 3 to 4 times a week to kind of add up to that 11 to 15.
Yeah.
And then the breath work that you mentioned, what kind of breath work are we talking about with the cold immersion?
I mean, the most data is with the Wim Hof breath work. He's got pounds and pounds and mountains of data. Breath work is great no matter what you're doing. I mean, you could just do some box breathing. I mean, that has been shown to have been helpful with cold immersion. There are people who do hyperventilatory breath work that works for them. It's not as common. So just the breath work of controlling the breath, the effect on the nervous system, the effect on the brain, the effect on your neurotransmitters all are beneficial. So you're getting that in conjunction with the benefits of the cold.
Beautiful. Let's talk about supplements a little bit. So there's, of course, so many supplements out there that people might be tempted towards. What's kind of your general view, first of all, on supplements for anti-aging and how we might think about which ones are beneficial, harmful, all of that kind of thing?
Like I said, I think throughout, my opinions have kind of changed a little bit. There's ones that are golden. There's a lot of these ones that have like 15 medicines and 15 supplements in one are usually not the best ideas, in my opinion, just because what's happening is either your body's not going to like one of them for whatever reason. And to get all 15 in them and make the product not cost $5,000, it's usually a lower dose of most of the products that are out there. So there's I don't love those multi-purpose products. I think there's some really good supplements that are out there that have great data behind them. Again, I have a starter stack of like 3 or 4 start patients on in most cases. And then we also treat, again, whatever their goals are, be it brain, be it inflammation, be it weight loss or whatever it happens to be. I mean, my starters are definitely, big ones are definitely NAD, especially I like NMN. There's some people like NR, they both have good studies on them. Vitamin D has just so many benefits to it. Berberine, in terms of its insulin sensitivity, inflammation, really good starter. Omega-3 fish oil has just an insane amount of benefits to it. So those are kind of the basic ones. And then I love a product called Spermidine. Just be aware of patients who are gluten sensitive or gluten allergic. There are most of the products that have gluten in it because it's derived from wheat germ. There are some there's now a gluten-free version out there. But for the people who are in the anti-aging space, and there were 9 pillars of aging. I think now they're up to 15, but it does the most of any product that's out there in terms of the different categories compared to anything out there, including rapamycin, including metformin. So I think that's a product that people should be doing. And if I had one more in there, I mean, I could probably list 20 that have benefits for a lot of people. I love BPC-157, which is the peptide. It's great for everything from inflammation, gut health, boost nitric oxide levels. I think that's a really good product. And there's a new, and again, there's a product that works on what we call plasmalogens, which I think you're going to hear a lot more about in the near future, that has a lot of great benefits in terms of general health as well as brain health. I'm starting a lot of my patients on that. And the last product I'll mention is a product called TA65, which also has really good immune boosting properties as well. So that's probably, I mean, again, that's six or seven. Again, there's probably another 20 I could ream off if you give me time, but that's probably what I would start with.
If you were starting people on supplements, would you start all of those at once? Like we kind of talked about earlier, would you start a whole bunch of things together, or would you do one at a time? How would you
It depends who I'm talking to. In most cases, I'm starting them on most of those at the same time. But like I said, most of my patients are on some of those. Most patients are taking vitamin D at this point. Most patients are taking fish oil at this point. Some patients are taking NAD supplements at this point. So I'm not the one adding usually all those at one time. Occasionally it happens. I'll add six or seven. I mean, again, right? One of the first questions I ask with all my patients are, how many things do you want to do at one time? Do you want to go down the rabbit hole, or do you want to go baby steps? Both work. Just obviously one's going to be faster than the other, and one may have a little more side effects. And again, especially in the anti-aging field, unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is not yet covered by insurance. And you can't get your time back. So if these patients, they know that they're not going to have the time to do half these things, if they're not going to do cold plunging, if they're not going to take their supplements, they want one or two quick high yield things, that's what they can do. Like I said, there's foundational things I can give them. I also have patients who, look, I am very well off. I have all the time in the world. This is what I want to do. Then you can work that way. I usually will give them at least 3 to 5 to start with in most cases, and they're fine with that. When you get above that is when you get a little bit kind of, you doubt how much you're going to be able to do, especially when you start adding it. Now, a lot of more patients are doing self-injections at home or IVs and other things as well. But 3 to 5 is a good starter point. But most patients can do that. That's not really that complicated.
Yeah. So one question, and this is specifically for anti-aging and longevity supplements. Some supplements you can feel, caffeine, stimulants, etc. However, when you take something for longevity, how do you actually know that it's working? Is there ways we can measure, or something that people can feel?
I mean, there's no perfect answer there. I mean, there's different answers for different things. In most cases, either going to feel something. I mean, for most of the ones that I mentioned, I know most patients will feel things either within the first 2 to 6 weeks. We'll see something on their lab work within the first 3 months that shows that it's working. Otherwise, sometimes they just have to go on faith. I mean, I'm trying to think of, there really aren't that many that patients don't feel in some way, shape, or form. The way I tell patients is, it's kind of like how you know your steak is good or your fish is good. You just know that something's different or something's good. You have this innate sense about it. But of the ones I just reeled off, I mean, except for maybe vitamin D to a certain extent, most patients will feel something from all of those. But again, the rest will be lab work. But I think, again, the goal is just to temper expectations and let patients know what they're going to feel. I tell patients if they're going to do NAD, they may feel something initially. They may not feel something for 2 months. BBC, which is a peptide, you may feel that within 1 week. So I think them understanding what to look for, I think, also helps that. I'm trying to think. I mean, really, again, almost every supplement that I normally recommend, they notice it. So it's not as big of an issue. That's not really as much of an issue as it used to be. When we were doing, like, more people were doing like a multivitamin thing, or we were just doing like vitamin E, or kind of more general things that help power other things, like CoQ10 may be one of those where you may not know you need CoQ10 for a lot of things and it's very helpful, but that's not something most people don't say, wow, I'm on CoQ10, I want to keep taking it. But most of the other ones you can kind of tell either through labs or where you feel.
And what about cautions that you might give, like certain supplements that might have harmful side effects, or that you feel like people need to be careful with, or that the data is just not there for?
I mean, overall with supplements, you want to make sure you're getting them from reputable companies. Be very careful getting things overseas, because sometimes they're not regulated as well as they are here in the US. I mean, some of them are not regulated by the FDA, there are still some oversight on most of these supplements. Things are taken off the market because they have too many problems or side effects. So, I mean, make sure, especially for people who are taking them because they have an issue specifically, you want to limit the amount of fillers that are in there. The sugar, a lot of supplements, unfortunately, the cheaper they are, they have either a lot of fillers to keep them cheaper or have some sugar in there. So you're taking a supplement like a fish oil or a melatonin, but there's sugar in there. So you're kind of, again, you're only going to get so much. There's still vitamin gummies, drives me crazy. Because it's, I mean, they look like a Sour Patch Kid to make people take them, but you're probably getting more side effects and benefits from them. I mean, it's kind of the same thing that people complain about, like Flintstone vitamins, which have more sugar than you would get from like a lot of other foods. So that's the second thing. And then beware of claims that are just ridiculous at this. Most, very few vitamins or supplements are going to cure anything, I guess, at this point. They're very helpful. If the claims are too good to be true, they probably are, or talk about it with your doctor. And also dosing, and now, again, like I said, since the paradigm is switched where it used to be, when everybody's getting prescriptions, your doctor could specifically control interactions and specifically control the dosing. I have patients now coming in, I saw on this Reddit board, or I saw on this, I'm not going to mention the podcast, but so-and-so said he's taking high dose this. And they come in, they're just taking like ridiculous doses, especially on the podcast part of it. These guys, if they mess something up, either they have a doctor advising them or can fix the problem, as opposed to you who may not have that availability or that ability to do that. So start low, go slow, watch for fillers, and don't buy the hype is probably the best advice I can give right now. I mean, if you're really a good searcher, there should be data on what they're saying. If you can't back up what they say, like I'm trying to think where I read it. I think 2 or 3 days ago, a prominent science person who was a scientist, now is in the supplement business, put up a thing that like 10 doctors and scientists within 5 minutes said, that's not true. The study they even put up the claim, it actually says the opposite of what they're claiming. It was just, you got to be very careful. Weird place to look is actually Twitter. A lot of people now on Twitter are become very watchdoggy, and that they're really blasting certain things out there, and it's a good place to potentially look, start your search as well. Maybe a weird place that not thought of, but just actually a lot of really good information on Twitter.
Super important, just kind of overall message, because people I think are aware that the pharmaceutical companies are pushing biased data, but people selling supplements definitely can be too, and really important to be careful about that.
Yeah, that is true. I know there's a cure for that at this point, but
yeah. Just as we're kind of closing our conversation here, do you have any words of inspiration, any last messages that you'd like to share with people out there who are looking to age well and looking to kind of optimize their lives?
The main thing is get the foundation started. Know what your goals are, the first things. If your goal, like I said, if your goal is to lose weight, if your goal is to decrease inflammation, have a clear A to B pathway. Go step by step. And then the other thing I would say is, again, I have cheesy analogies, is you want to be taking from all the buckets, meaning with aging right now, one thing doesn't do everything. So no matter what, we know you need to decrease inflammation, do something to decrease inflammation, do something to monitor, deal with your stress. It could be technology, it could be breath work, it could be a supplement, it could be a prescription medication. You want to control your mitochondria. That's going to be part, definitely is now pushed its way into the mainstream. We know it affects normal health, it affects everything. You want to do certain things like to work on your mitochondria. Again, you want to do something to maximize your hormones. So you want to kind of do a lot of all those things to work together. Everything is a symphony. If one part isn't work, if one instrument is off, everything's off. Same thing with your body. You could be doing all these things for recovery, but if your diet stinks or you're not taking, I mean, I have a patient who just don't even take enough protein to build muscle, it doesn't work as well. It just goes off the tracks. So it's understand what you're trying to get to. And then also you want to, again, like I said, you want to partake in different buckets. And like I said before, you want to do certain things at the same time, because that's where things, because your body has multiple different pathways going at the same time. It's not just one thing. So you get what you want to fix your mitochondria, but you also want to work on your gut health. So that's the things that you kind of want to work towards. But there's so much coming up in the next, like I said, 18 months to 3 years that is going to blow your mind in terms of the benefits of what's out there between supplements and lifestyle changes and wearables, and it's just going to be incredible. And you want to work, if you want to be on the forefront, work with somebody who is on, who understands how to implement these things. And it may not be the same person. I mean, there's things that I'm good with a lot of things. There's things I just don't know how to do. I'm going to refer them to somebody who knows that. I'm not a user. I know how to do breathwork, but I'm not a breathwork instructor. I'm going to refer to one of my friends or colleagues who's really good with breathwork. So you want to have a garden, different things.
Beautiful message. Amir, do you have any final questions?
I think that's an awesome message, actually, because a lot of people get fixated on one or two methods that everybody's talking about. But like you said, I think there's no one secret drug or ingredient or method to promote longevity, health, and wellness. The body as a whole has to be considered, right? And that's a key takeaway for people to know. And it's probably best to find the right professional to actually guide him through, because it's very hard to always know by yourself without some testing.
I do want to put an asterisk there. I mean, I'm probably going to open up two rabbit holes as we finish up. Two things that people who are listening should look into. That, again, they're not ready for prime time now. One would be rapamycin, which has incredible studies probably coming out in the next year to 18 months that may do more things than anything else, both from an anti-aging perspective as well as a health maintenance perspective. And the other one, which may be a little bit taboo to some people, are psychedelics. Which again, there the studies not only on this from a psychiatric, but an immune affecting method, as well as decreasing inflammation. So those are two things for people over the next year or so to really look for that are going to probably be really ready for prime time. And then they may be those things that are very all encompassing, but we'll have to see.
Hopefully we'll get the chance to do a podcast with you in another year or 18 months, and we can talk about some of this new data, rabbit hole that a little bit.
Definitely. Anytime.
Thank you so much for being here with us, Dr. Pavan. We really, really appreciate your time and so much information that you shared with people. That's really helpful. So thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. That was great.